Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 10.
Cyril, were there any cases of note that you were involved in?
Yep. But before that, I think I should tell you that I rejoined the police on the 28th of August 45, and I sat the sergeant's exam on the 15th of December 45, and I passed. About 2 months later, I'd been on night duty. I was living then with my a couple of rooms and a kitchen with my brother-in-law, Doreen's brother, in Streatham. And I'd been on night duty, and a copper from the local net came round about 12 o'clock, and he said, you've got to go before the selection board at 2 o'clock this afternoon. I wasn't very happy about that, because they should have given me plenty of warning. Anyway, I went up to McNaughton House before the selection board, was called in. There was a deputy assistant commissioner and four superintendents on the board. I wasn't wearing a helmet, I was just wearing my ordinary serge jacket, and sat down, and they said, you're Scorpius 125409. I said, yes, sir. And he said, wear your medal ribbons. Now, they were all, of course, blokes who'd been in the First World War, had got medal ribbons up. The deputy assistant commissioner had also got a whole string of them. And I said to them, I don't bother to wear them. And they said, why not? I said, I've only got the medals that were issued out on rations. I've got no decorations. That didn't go down too well. They asked me a lot of questions. And then one of them said to me, you rejoined the police on the 28th and took your sergeant's exam on 28th of September, and you took your sergeant's exam on the 15th of December. I said, yes, sir. He said, you were very lucky to have passed. I said, what do you mean, lucky? I said, I swatted my guts out on that instruction book. I said, I'd been out of the police for 4 years. I have got a reasonable memory, but I said, I went through that instruction book page after page, so I knew it almost as well as I did when I left Peel House. I said, there was no luck about it whatsoever. It was sheer hard graft. And they said, right, that's it. And off I went. I was told that I'd passed the exam, and that's why I see here on my record sheet they've ticked off Sergeant, our second class sergeant, 9th of February 1946, SUP. I suppose that's when they put me on the list, that I was I could be an acting sergeant. And from then onwards, I did a lot of job as acting sergeant, completely unpaid. I don't know whether they get paid these days, but we didn't. You were acting sergeant. And I thought, Freemasonry, of course, was rampant, and so was the Catholic Guild. I knew that I hadn't pleased the selection board, and I thought, I'm not going to get anywhere in this job at all, because on the selection board, of course, you had to be nominated by them to be sergeant, whereas under the old system, it was in order of merit. And the odd thing is, just after I left the Met Police, they switched back to order of merit. The bloke on the top of the list was made sergeant, and then he went down. So I applied in 46 to join become an emergency teacher. There was a training scheme called the Emergency Teachers Training Scheme, where ex-servicemen could apply to become teachers. It was a 13-month course, which, of course, instead of the 2 years full training course you had, which meant it was very, very crammed, and for that I got a payment of £600 a year in four quarterly payments. Now, that meant, of course, you had to be very careful with your money during that course. I passed that. I stayed on in the police, but of course, as there was a waiting list to go on these courses, I didn't go on it until I retired from the police, which was on the 14th of March, 1948. And by then I got 11 years, 92 days service in, but approved service was only 10 years, 191 days, because they didn't count service in those days until you reached the age of 20. So I lost nearly 8 months' service, which has, of course, cost me quite a lot of money on my pension. I haven't worked it out, but it is over. I've been drawing a pension now for 25 years, and it does work out quite a bit on that, I should think. Okay. I say most of the police service was very mundane, but I think there are two stories which would be worth recording. During the strike at the Savoy Hotel, which was organised by communists, and the strike was, of course, by the workers at the hotel, particularly kitchen and other staff, well supported by the communists. There had been an occasion which I think is worth recording. I showed you the police photograph of where we made the arrests of the people who were lying down, stopping the tankers from going in. Now, one of the pickets there was a little bit daft. In fact, he was as thick as a mentally retarded chihuahua, and I was on point duty as usual outside the Savoy Hotel. That's at the junction of Savoy Court and the Strand, the main entrance to the hotel. Now, of course, there were no pickets there, as only guests and porters were there, and on the corner of Savoy Court is the Savoy Tailors Guild, a very, very good tailor, but nothing whatsoever to do with the Savoy Hotel. And I was on point duty there at Savoy Court and the Strand one morning, and the shift was from 8 until 4. And just after I got there, it'd be about 8 o'clock in the morning, some glaziers came to change a big plate glass window in the Savoy Tailors Guild. It was a very, very big window. I reckon it must have been about 14 feet by about 10 feet high, a very big window. And of course, you know, they use these suction pads to get the old glass out, and they took it all out carefully. And then they put the new glass in. And that took a long time because it had to be positioned exactly. They used all these great sucker pads to get it in position and then seal it all up. And then stood back to admire their work. And I saw this daft picket come walking along the Strand, because they did their picketing in Savoy Street at the back of the hotel. I saw him walking along the Strand towards the front of the Savoy Hotel. I saw him walking along, and I knew he wasn't all there. And he walked into Savoy Court, stood about 10 feet away from this plate glass window, and then he chucked a bloody great brick and smack in the middle of the plate glass window, which cracked in all directions. The looks on the face of these glaziers was something to see. But I was across there. I grabbed him and I grabbed the brick before anybody could touch him. And up he goes to Bow Street, where he's charged with willful damage. Appears in court the following morning and gets, he was sent to prison for a week. The other story I think is interesting is concerning a brothel. Now, in my days, the definition of a brothel was a building from which two or more prostitutes operated. One prostitute in a building by herself, okay. Two in the same building, operating at the same time, that was a brothel. If they were sharing a room on shifts, so that there was one working at a time, that wasn't a brothel. I don't know whether the same thing operates now. But of course, the prostitutes were not committing any offence. It was the person to whom they were paying money who was called the brothel keeper. Now, we had a couple of plainclothes blokes, vice blokes at Bow Street, who used to wander around checking on urinals for puffs, professional wankers, and other people who were committing obvious sexual offences. And one of them had been in the Strand Palace Hotel, which of course is one of Joey Lyons' corner houses, on the corner of Craven Street and the Strand. And in the rest, they were all night, all day and all night. Do you remember those? Now, the Strand Palace one, of course, was off Craven Street, and Craven Street was full of little boarding houses, like most rail termini have. This was for Charing Cross. And they were practically all little boarding houses. And this bloke had spotted two Toms working the restaurant in the Strand Corner House at night. They weren't doing it, obviously. They were just going there and sitting having a cup of coffee. Because, of course, if the Joey Lyons staff knew they were Toms, they were turfed out. And he had spotted that they were both of them were using one of these boarding houses, both of them. So that, of course, made it a brothel. I was on night duty, and after we'd come off parade, my section sergeant said to me, meet me in the forecourt of Charing Cross Station about 1:30. He didn't say why. So I met him, and he had a policewoman with him. And he said, we've got to wait for the plainclothes bloke, I forget his name, to pass on something, and then we act. So we hung on, and about 2 o'clock, this plainclothes bloke came out and said, they're both there. So we go to this boarding house in Craven Street. It's got a basement where the owner lives, so I went down and bashed on the door there and woke her up. And the sergeant came down and he said, I've got a warrant to serve these premises as it is a brothel. And a brothel, she said. And she was absolutely staggered that it was a brothel. And he said, right, open the front door. So he went upstairs and opened the front door. And she was very irate, this woman. She said, a brothel? Not a brothel. And so this plainclothes bloke who was there said, there are two prostitutes who are staying at this hotel. They're in their rooms at this moment. He said, let me look at your register. And so he had a look, and there it was, Elsie Jones and Gladys Summers, shall I say. He noted the rooms. He said, they are two prostitutes. And he said, you know they're prostitutes. And she said, no, she didn't know. But she did know, because it was about, in those days, it was about £15 a night for a double room for bed and breakfast. And she was, without any doubt, charging these Toms a lot more than that, and they weren't getting any breakfast. So we go up to the first room, bash on the door, and I try the handle, and it's open. So we walk in, four of us walk in, switch the light on, and there was the Tom in bed with her client, looking very startled, and we said, "This is a police raid. We simply want to know one or two facts." And the sergeant said, "Your name is Elsie Jones?" She said, "Yes." He said, "You are a common prostitute?" She said, "Yes." He said, "And the gentleman in bed with you is a client who is paying for your services?" And she said, "Yes." So the sergeant said, "Right, thank you. It would have been lovely if we'd have known that American term. Have a nice day, wouldn't it?" "Have a nice night." And out we went. The other room, it was locked. Bashed on the door. Said, "This is a police raid, open up." After about 30 seconds, the door was opened. And there was a Tom wearing a dressing gown, nothing else underneath. And a bloke in bed with the sheets over his head. The sergeant said, "Your name is Daddy Summers?" She said, "Yes." "You are a common prostitute?" She said, "Yes." "And the gentleman in bed is a client who is paying for your services?" And she said, "Yes." So the sergeant said to the bloke in the bed, he said, "You can take the collars off, you're all right." And out we went. Now, I thought, that's it. And so did the plainclothes bloke. But this sergeant was a stickler. He said, "I've got a search warrant, and we're going to search the whole place." So, the plainclothes bloke said, "Right, I'm off," and out he went. Now, there were eight rooms in this hotel. The two Toms we've covered, there were three empty rooms, and two single rooms, and a double room. So we went up to the single rooms, bashed on the doors, and I think there were reps or commercial travellers who opened up, and they said, "This is a police." Sergeant said, "This is a police raid. May we come in and have a look?" And had a look. Nobody in there in either of the rooms. And we said, "Right, we're sorry to disturb you," and out we went. Now, can you imagine what would happen these days if that would if that had happened? There'd be an action immediately against the police, wouldn't there? Walking their sleep being disturbed. So there was the one other room, and this Mrs. Court, her name was, said, she said, no. She said, "The lady in that room works in a solicitor's office. She lives out in the country, and she stays there from Sunday night until Friday night, and then goes home for the weekend. She's a very respectable person." Made no odds with this sergeant. Up we go the stairs. And we bash on the door. "Police raid. A warrant to search these premises." We could hear some movement inside, but the door didn't open. We kept on bashing and bashing. And after about, I would say, a good 2 minutes, the door opened. And this blonde woman of about 35 opened the door wearing a dressing gown. So the three of us went in. Mrs. Court stayed outside. And we went in, and just at the back of the door, out of sight of the corridor outside, was a wardrobe about 5 feet high and I'd say about 3 feet wide. And the door was about 12 inches, and all women's clothes were covering the door. So the policewoman went up, took these clothes off, and there, inside the wardrobe, was a bloke, doubled up, really doubled up, and I said to him, "Right, come out, Mush." He said, I can't, I'm stuck. And so I had to grab him by the arm and literally pull him out. And he was a big bloke, well over 6 feet, very heavily built. How the hell she got him in the wardrobe, I don't know. But as soon as he got out, he started dancing up and down and saying, don't let Mrs. Court see me. Don't let Mrs. Court see me. But of course, Mrs. Court had become a little bit impatient standing outside. So she walks into the room, looks at this bloke, and she said, John, what are you doing here? It was her son. He had used to come up to see his mum, and the policewoman found out later. He used to come up to see his mum once a week, leave to go home to his wife, but instead of, he went out of the basement where they lived, and then of course he got a key, went into the front door, up to this woman's room, and of course hadn't been home to his wife. So that really put the kibosh on poor old Mrs. Court. Anyway, she was done for running a disorderly house, and I think she got fined about £200. But I thought that might be of interest to you. Having finished and got the certificate as a teacher after the 13-month course, oh, by the way, I specialised in English and history. I applied to, as I was living in Streatham, I applied to London County Council, and they posted me to a junior school in Charles Dickens School in Southwark. I was, of course, a brand new teacher. We had had some teaching practice, but I think it was more difficult to start off a job in teaching than it was in the police, or when I was a junior clerk before joining the police, or in the RAF. But as I was used, of course, to discipline, I soon got hold of it, and I was just appointed to this school, and I then moved to from my brother-in-law's house to a council flat in Merton. So I applied to Surrey County Council for a job, and they posted me in 1951 to Fortescue Junior School, which is in Colliers Wood. And it's there that I made the best friends I ever made in teaching, because all the men there, and there were quite a lot of men in a junior school, and nowadays, of course, you find hardly any men at all in junior schools, and they'd all been in the services. Johnny Johnson, who became a very good friend of mine, had been a spit pilot. Delmy Thomas, not the one who played rugby for Wales, he had been in the RAF as a drill instructor. And he also became a very good friend of mine until he died. Johnny is still alive, but he lives down in Windsor now. He's 87, and we keep in touch by phone and by card, but I don't ever see him. The others were... Delmy then married the deputy head of that school, Wynne Thomas, and she, of course, became a good friend, and we in touch with her. I did 1951 is when I went to Fortescue, and then we moved from Merton up to our present house in Tadworth. So I started applying for jobs nearby, and I got a job at Norke Junior and Infant School, which is on the Norke Estate. It's now called something past, not called something Mead School. Now most of the staff there were women, only two men. Both had been in the services, but I didn't make particular friends with them. I applied for several promotions, deputy heads. of various schools, but I'd made an enemy of one of the Surrey County Council's inspectors. To make up my money, I used to do coaching, and I used to charge £10 an hour to coach kids through the 11 plus. And I was coaching a boy from Langley Vale, and his headmistress had complained to this Inspector Sibley that it was unfair that this boy should receive coaching. And the odd thing was, he was a policeman's son. I got on Cornish, this copper's name was, and he'd been an air gunner in the RAF. We got on very well, he and I. And Sibley came to Norwich School one day to as a general inspection, and then he told the headmistress that he wanted to see me. So I went in to see him, and he said, I understand that you are coaching this boy Cornish from Langley Vale School. I said, yes. He said, well, he said, I think it's unfair. I want you to stop. I said, sir, I said, you cannot tell me what I am to do in my own time. I said, it's got nothing at all to do with my career. I'm doing my job efficiently here. And I said, we've just been inspected by the chief inspector of Surrey, who gave me a glowing report. And I said, it's got nothing so whatsoever to do. And I am ignoring your request. Oh, he said, off. I think I put in round about 20 applications. This would be from about 1957. No, maybe 58. That would mean I would have got nearly 10 years' service in for deputy heads, and I never got called for one. I did see this chief inspector again and told him I wasn't receiving anything, but I thought, this is hopeless, I'm not going to get anywhere with him. Now, Johnny Johnson, the Spitfire pilot I mentioned I made a friend of at Fortescue, was now a headmaster at Fleetwood Secondary School in Chessington. And I told him I was fed up. He said, I've got a vacancy, apply. So I applied, and then in 1961, I was appointed to teach at the secondary school at Fleetwood, Chessington. And I was again teaching English and history. It was an all-boys school when I got there. And it was lovely just teaching all boys, no girls. You know, I have all these sisters and daughters and sisters-in-law, a lot of women. I was glad to get away from women. But after 1 year, they made it a mixed school. And so we had an intake of 60 young girls, all wearing the school uniform, all looking gorgeous, marvellous. I was the only one on the staff who'd had experience of teaching girls, apart from two of the women on the staff. And these men, the men teachers, had no experience whatsoever. So these young, beautiful little girls, innocent little girls, were running rings around me, but they weren't running rings around me. Now, of course, I was dark then, and I had a moustache, and I used to chase them uphill and down dale, so they nicknamed me Hitler. I was there for 6 years, until 1967. Again, I made one good friend who has since died. And in 1967, I applied for the job of master in charge of the junior school of Thurfield in Leatherhead.